American values out the window. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump chose not to condemn Saudi Arabia for the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. What message does that send to other nations?
It sets a terrible precedent in countering the very values on this Thanksgiving that we hold near and dear, the ideas of justice and basic decency. This seems to be almost throwing it out the window.
Also, the Greek town of Mati was devastated by fire over the summer. Now some young people from Mati are sending their support to wildfire survivors in California.
When this was happening to us here, we kind of wished that there was someone that could relate to us. So I'm really glad that I could be that person for someone else.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. Did the Crown Prince know about the killing of Jamal Khashoggi? Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. So said President Trump yesterday. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister went further today. Adel Al-Jubeir told my BBC colleague Lise Doucette that any criticism of Mohammed bin Salman is a red line. Lise spoke with the minister in Riyadh, and she pressed him on some of the evidence we've come to learn about the murder.
Why did they want Jamal Khashoggi back, and that he was such a threat that if he didn't want to come back, he had to be killed?
Jamal Khashoggi was not wanted in Saudi Arabia.
But he obviously was. Jamal Khashoggi. 15 members went to Saudi Arabia, members of Crown Prince Mohammed's own personal guard,
what about,
a leading forensic expert, and a body double.
What about rogue operation? Do people not understand?
That's hardly rogue.
People exceeded their authorities. People committed a crime, and people are going to be held accountable for it.
Some in Congress want answers. Senators from both parties called today for a new investigation into Khashoggi's murder. They want to know specifically, what did the Saudi Crown Prince know about the killing? As for that question, the Saudi foreign minister had this to say.
The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia is not involved in this. We have made that very clear. We have an investigation that's ongoing, and we will punish the individuals who are responsible for this, and we will make sure it doesn't happen again.
Al-Jubeir echoed Tuesday's statement from President Trump, expressing strong support for the U.S.-Saudi alliance. But that statement has not gone over well with many people. Robin Wright, a contributor to The New Yorker, is one of them.
It was an outrageous statement by any American leader about the murder of anyone, anywhere, and that we have so much information about this grisly death. And the audio recordings of the act itself, and the president opts to basically ignore it, to give Saudi Arabia a pass for this egregious act of murder and the dismemberment of a member of the human race.
I mean, looking at the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, their editorial board is hardly a haven of doves, but they posted a scathing rebuke of Trump's statement, including this sentence: "We are unsure what goal Mr. Trump hoped to achieve with what can only be described as a raw and brutalist version of foreign policy realpolitik." Care to add your concerns to that?
Yes, I think this sets a terrible precedent for America's image in the 21st century when we're trying to hold other governments, including Iran, North Korea, the Soviet Union, to account for its egregious Human Rights Act. It sets a terrible precedent in countering the very values on this Thanksgiving that we hold near and dear, the ideas of justice, basic decency, the right of free speech and freedom of worship. And the thing that's most striking about the president's statement is that it's really ultimately so un-American.
Let me ask you this. Some people see Trump's statement simply as an honest representation of long-term U.S. policy in the Mideast, especially with Saudi Arabia, just straightforward realpolitik, the difference being that Trump said it like it is. Is there some truth to that?
Well, there is in a way that American governments have long looked at what is the cost-benefit ratio in a relationship. But the truth is that the murder of Jamal Khashoggi was not the first act of aggression by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Here's a man who invaded Yemen 3 years ago and has produced the world's its biggest humanitarian crisis of the 21st century. He has blockaded neighboring country, Qatar, where the U.S. has its military base, its main military base, to carry out the operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. The Crown Prince also forced the resignation of the Prime Minister of Lebanon and forced him to do it on Saudi television. So the precedent we're seeing play out is really over who are our allies and what malign behavior will we tolerate. And I think that this is one of those tipping points that to kill someone, to lure them to your own diplomatic facility in another country, murder them so deliberately, carrying a bone saw, sending a hit squad, and then dismembering the body and not even returning the remains. Remember, we still don't know where Jamal Khashoggi's body is.
Right. A lot of people are stunned by Trump's statement yesterday. What were you really expecting him to say?
Well, the fact that the government, the State Department, and the Treasury had sanctioned 17 Saudis indicated that perhaps there might be recognition of what happened, particularly given the pressure that Congress has exerted on the basis of something called the Magnitsky Act, which allows and requires the government to act within 120 days when there are serious human rights abuses. The president could have imposed some kind of sanctions. There are a lot of other steps he could have taken, you know, that would not have given a murderer a total pass.
You seem to suggest the Khashoggi killing is a line that's been crossed. Republican diehards like Bob Corker and Lindsey Graham, they don't like Trump's position on this. What is the domestic significance politically of this moment with Saudi Arabia, do you think?
It's very interesting, the divide within the Republican Party on what to do. The president has taken one path, basically punting the issue of holding Saudi Arabia to account, whereas Congress very much wants to take action and may even be galvanized by the president's statement. They want to cut off arms sales to the kingdom because until there's some movement on the Yemen war. You know, there's a lot of talk about what can Congress do that the president won't. And it's very striking that whether it's Bob Corker, Lindsey Graham from the Republican side, and in perhaps the only bipartisan effort in Congress, you see the Democrats siding with the Republicans and in a joint letter I've written the president asking him to make a formal determination of what role Mohammed bin Salman played in this murder. That's really striking.
I'm curious to know what you think, whether other authoritarians or would-be authoritarians like this, whatever reaction to a murder of an American resident, how is that going to empower them? And who are they?
Oh, I think that there are a number of autocrats around the world who will think this gives them latitude to do whatever they want against their dissidents, whether they're actually in their countries or living abroad. Jamal Khashoggi came to the United States. He had been educated in Indiana. He had three sons who were born here and are American citizens. And he came here from exile in 2017 because he believed it was the safest place on earth. And the idea that America wouldn't or couldn't protect him or is letting a murderer get away with it will send a message to autocrats around the world that there's certainly some latitude. This is, after all, the 21st century. And given the values that have been established since the end of World War II and the UN Declaration of Human Rights, whether it's a post-Cold War world when we've seen odious ideologies, whether it's communism or apartheid or the military dictatorships in Latin America, these became unacceptable. Well, this kind of puts all this back on the table again as if we don't care.
Journalist Robin Wright, contributing writer to The New Yorker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For a long time, the perception has been that it's all about business between Washington and Riyadh. That really seems to be the rock bottom line for President Trump and Mohammed bin Salman. There is a backlash underway, though. Germany announced this week that it is putting all weapons sales to Saudi Arabia on hold. When Trump spoke to reporters yesterday, he talked about the Saudis' hundreds of billions of dollars in orders from American companies. He translated that into U.S. jobs. He said hundreds of thousands of them. Here's a president last month talking about what's at stake with Saudi Arabia.
600,000 jobs, maybe more than that. And it would be very hurtful to this country if we said, oh, we're not going to sell it to you.
600,000. That number might be a little high, Marco.
The World's Stephen Snyder has been tracking the sale of U.S. weapons to Saudi Arabia.
Some experts are putting the number of U.S. jobs dependent on Saudi Arabia as much, much lower.
I don't think the president knows how many jobs are connected with arms sales to Saudi Arabia. You know, he said there's a million jobs, 500,000 jobs. When he met with Mohammed bin Salman in the White House, he had a chart that said 40,000 jobs. My estimate is it could be half of that. You know, it's less than 0.03% of the U.S. labor force.
That's William D. Hartung. He follows this stuff at the Center for International Policy.
Well, if you look at sales to Saudi Arabia in terms of deliveries that happen every year, that's about $2.5 billion a year, a couple percentage points of what the Pentagon spends.
So, Stephen, what exactly do the Saudis buy from the U.S.?
All kinds of military hardware. F-15 fighter jets, for example, from Boeing. Helicopters from Boeing and Sikorsky. Combat ships from Lockheed Martin. Laser-guided bombs from Raytheon. Those are some of the big-ticket items.
And in Donald Trump's statement yesterday, he suggested that if U.S. companies stop selling to the Saudis, then China and Russia will fill the void, and they'll get the profits. Is that true?
Yeah, they could. But in the short term, that would be really tough. William Hartung says that the Saudis are heavily invested in U.S. weapon systems.
Two-thirds of their air force comes from the United States. They have thousands of armored vehicles and tens of thousands of bombs from the United States. All of those need support.
So the Saudis need the U.S. for its weapon systems. But what about those American workers?
Well, Hartung says it's tens of thousands of jobs, not hundreds of thousands of jobs. Even though it's serious for anybody who loses a job, it's not a major impact on the U.S. economy, though it would be felt in places where the weapons are made. Let me give you one example. F-15s. Mm. The F-15SA, special plane made for Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the only customer in the world for these. The U.S. doesn't even use them anymore. They're made at a Boeing plant in St. Louis and another one in St. Charles, Missouri. In our sample, there were about $3 billion in support contracts to maintain and upgrade those planes, with work that's going to be done in about 20 different U.S. cities. And many Americans also work on F-15s inside Saudi Arabia.
Right, as advisors and maintenance and all that stuff that you need for those expensive jets.
Yes. Helicopters, combat ships, bombs, they all get made the same way with a really long supply chain that stretches across the U.S.
It sounds like there would be a big impact.
Well, in some communities it would be, but experts say there's a backlog on many orders from the Pentagon and from foreign customers, and that many workers would be transferred to those production lines.
So, as we said earlier, Germany has stopped delivering weapons to Saudi Arabia now. That is not happening here.
No. In fact, since the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Defense Department has announced 5 new contracts with Saudi Arabia. The most recent one was on Monday.
All righty, the world's Stephen Snyder, looking at weapons the U.S. sells to Saudi Arabia. Thanks very much for this, Stephen.
Thanks, Marco.
One more story now from the Middle East. A court in the United Arab Emirates has sentenced a British PhD student to life in prison for spying. Matthew Hedges is 31 years old. He says he's innocent and that he was only in the UAE doing research on the country's security strategy. The British government said it was deeply shocked and disappointed by this news and that there will be serious diplomatic consequences. Here's the BBC's Paul Adams with more.
The hearing in Abu Dhabi lasted 5 minutes. Matthew Hedges' lawyer was not present. His wife, Daniela, said she was in complete shock and insisted once again that her husband was innocent. She said the Foreign Office knew this and had made it clear to the UAE authorities that Mr. Hedges was not spying for Britain. The Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, said the verdict was not what Britain expected from a friend and trusted partner. In an unusually strongly worded statement, he said he had repeatedly made it clear that the UAE's handling of the case would have repercussions for relations between the two countries. I regret the fact, he said, that we have reached this position, and I urge the UAE to reconsider. Today's decision comes as a complete surprise. 3 weeks ago, Mr. Hedges was released from solitary confinement and allowed to stay with family members in Dubai, pending today's hearing. They're now wondering how long it'll be before they see him again.
That's the BBC's Paul Adams. Solidarity for the people displaced by the wildfires in California from young Greeks who lived through a devastating fire this past summer there. That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We feel you, California. That's the message from a group of young people in Greece for the thousands of people affected by the Camp Fire in Northern California. Over the summer, Mati, a Greek resort town, was itself devastated by fires. The town was home for this group of young people, and the experience moved them to launch a social media campaign in support of Californians. It includes a series of black and white photos. In the background, the wreckage left behind by the summer's fires in Mati. In the foreground, folks are holding signs that read, "We feel you, California." Nyovi Tupai is a 17-year-old high school student who's part of the campaign.
We wanted to just kind of send a message of hope to the people in California, kind of letting them know that even though it really hurts right now, it's going to be okay.
I'm just curious, what prompted this? Did you see any specific news report or something you read that made you realize maybe we can send some hope to California?
It was mainly in all the news channels here in Greece.
Πάνω από 8.800 σπίτια μετατράπηκαν σε αποκαΐδια στην πόλη Paradise.
Οι συνθήκες που επικρατούν στην Καλιφόρνια, σύμφωνα τουλάχιστον...
Έχουν νεκρούς και 200 αγνοούμενους. Έχει φτάσει ο τραγικός απολογισμός της καταστροφικής πυρκαγιάς που κατακαίει την Καλιφόρνια.
It was everywhere on the internet. So, and the pictures that we were seeing of the fires really brought back memories of what happened here. So, we really related.
Yeah, before we go on, just tell me about what you did see in Mati over the summer. I mean, how badly were you affected?
Well, it was, Mati was like our personal paradise. It was like full of trees and it was just green and happy. And when the fire happened, it like took down nearly all the trees, making it pretty unrecognizable. And we lost, unfortunately, very unfortunately, 99 of the people in the community. In about 3 hours, the whole place had burned.
Yeah, the speed of the fire and the destruction and the human cost of it sound very similar to what's been happening in Northern California. I understand your own house burned down. Is everyone in your family okay?
Yeah, my house did burn down, very unfortunately, but I consider myself actually lucky for coming out with everyone, my family being okay. No one was injured, everyone was okay.
So where are you living right now?
Right now I live in a different part of Athens, where I have another house, very fortunately. Basically, there's other people that lost their homes in Mati that actually don't have a house somewhere else in Athens and are still living in camps since the 23rd of July. I'm actually very lucky that I have another house.
And your house that burned down in Mati, is that a house where you spent a lot of your childhood, most of your life?
My grandma and her family had that house. It was a gift from my great-grandma to my grandmother, so it was almost 100 years old. My dad grew up there. I basically grew up there. So we were all very, very attached to the specific house. It was full of history.
So what was it like going back to Mati to do this campaign, to take these photographs? What did you see and how did it feel?
Well, going back to Mati was a process. When the first time everyone went, it began with shock, sort of breaking down when you see what it's become, that you really don't recognize where you are. It's completely different. But as time goes by, you kind of get used to the destruction, although at times it hits you that, you know, this place wasn't always like this. Going back for the project, I was actually happy that I could actually help someone across the world that's, you know, going through what I went through. And it's like, I think when this was happening to us here, we kind of wished that there was someone that could relate to us. Hmm. So I'm really glad that I could be that person for someone else.
I mean, it sounds like going to Mati to do this campaign, take these pictures, was healing in some aspects. How are you doing, though, generally?
I'm coping. I'm moving on. I'm trying to get back to how I was. It's a sort of how I was before the fire, how I am now. It's a really, really life-changing thing.
Kind of a before and after moment.
And if you're my age or if you're younger than me, which a lot of kids in Mati are, it's affected them in so many ways psychologically. It's very heartbreaking to see young children not even being able to stand near a flame because they're so afraid. It really does affect your psychology And I'm sure all the people in California will be feeling the same thing. So I just want to stress the importance of psychological health and all of this. It really, really affects it.
Well, I am sure people in California hearing your voice are going to find some consolation in knowing that they're not alone in this. It sounds like Mati is a really special place for you. Is there any chance that your family would move back there?
We are definitely going to fix our house, even though it's pretty destroyed. We're going to try to fix it, and we're absolutely going to go back. There's no way. Everyone in the community is so attached to it. Like, it's unthinkable that, you know, we would never go there again. We're absolutely going back.
And what efforts have been made since the fires over the summer to rebuild in Mati?
We're basically fighting with the government here because generally there isn't much difference to how it was 4 months ago. The only real difference has been done by nature itself with some of the plants regrowing. The government hasn't really been much help. So basically any rebuilding efforts are really not underway so far. Mm.
When you posted this photograph, you and the young people of Mati, your youth group, on Instagram, you wrote, after visiting Mati again, "I have felt what it's like to look around me and not recognize surroundings that were once familiar. I have felt how it is to be wondering why and now what, to wonder what the future will hold." So I'm wondering if maybe you can just offer a few words for the people of California who are also wondering the same thing.
Well, if I could just stand somewhere and talk to all of them that are there, I would tell them that even though this seems like the worst possible disaster, really, really, truly, they will find a way back to where they were. The pain will become less. So that's why, especially why in the, I don't want to call it a poem, in what we wrote for the people in California under our post, we said that you will succeed, and by working together, your paradise will rise again. I truly, truly believe that.
Niovi Tupai, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
To see the photos from Mati with messages to California, go to the world's Instagram page. That's at PRI the world. I'm Marco Werman. Politics can be a touchy subject, but since the election of 2016, it's become one of those third rails for many Americans as they think about sitting down with family for Thanksgiving.
We all just try and not say anything in order to keep the peace.
But is politics getting less or more taboo this year after the midterms? That story ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've been talking about the caravan of Central American migrants for a while now. We followed their path out of Honduras, through Guatemala, and into Mexico. We've heard them portrayed in very different ways. President Trump has one perspective.
You have some very, very bad people in the caravan. You have some very tough criminal elements within the caravan. But I will seal off the border before they come into this country.
Rights advocates say the thousands of migrants who've now arrived in Tijuana are vulnerable people fleeing violence and poverty. Emily Green spent the day with one small group that's part of the caravan. They're migrants who are LGBTQ. They face persecution at home and also along the journey the caravan has taken. Before we begin, if you've got kids with you, the story has some details that may not be appropriate for them. Here's Emily.
I meet Belle on Saturday, outside the shelter where she and the other LGBTQ migrants are staying. She's 23, with platinum hair and a single dangly earring. Belle says she began identifying as female when she was 14. In Honduras, where she's from, that's not accepted.
Me odiaban por ser una chica trans y me insultaban.
She says people hated her for being trans and insulted her. They told her she had to be a man because she was born that way. Belle pulls out her phone.
Me lanzaron fuego a mi cuerpo.
I gasp as she shows me pictures. Her face and arms look charred. She says her neighbors threw gas on her and then a match. She spent 3 months in the hospital. Belle is not her real name. No one in this story wanted to use their real names for fear of jeopardizing their chance of getting asylum in the U.S. When Belle heard about the caravan to the U.S., she joined, didn't think twice. She dressed like a man to avoid harassment. But in southern Mexico, Belle met a gay man. They bought a rainbow flag and began walking with it. Belle says at every stop, more LGBTQ people saw the flag and latched on. Like Juanita, she's from Guatemala. She says they stuck together because they were being harassed, sometimes by others in the caravan. She says they'd get a head start in the mornings to keep their distance. Juanita joined the caravan because she says her older brother tried to rape her. He suspected she was gay and hated her for that. She says one day her brother came home and said, "I'm going to make you into a woman." She fought him off, but he beat her severely. Juanita says he was sent to prison, but he bribed his way out. Juanita hid, moved around, and in October joined the caravan. After the migrants arrived in Mexico City, a legal aid group paid for the LGBTQ contingent to travel separately by bus to Tijuana. There are around 80 of them. Here, in Tijuana, they sleep on the floor in one big room. It's cramped and smells of sweat. But the conditions are good compared to the outdoor sports complex where the other migrants from the caravan are staying. There's plenty of food here, and everyone here has access to lawyers. Most plan to ask for asylum in the U.S. Today, the mood is festive. 8 couples here are getting married. All of a sudden, I see a woman I met a month ago back in Guatemala, soon after the caravan set out.
Sandy, see? Oh my God, wow!
Sandy tells me, she's one of the people getting married today.
¿La conociste en el camino?
Sí.
She says during the journey, she fell in love with a woman from Honduras. There are also strategic reasons to get married. Lawyers say it strengthens their asylum claims because it shows they could face danger if they return to their countries. It could also keep couples together during the asylum process. But that's not what people are thinking about today.
People are getting really excited. Everybody is dressing up, trying on clothes, picking their rings.
5 p.m. arrives. One by one, the couples say their vows in a brief wedding ceremony.
Les presento a Rix y Alfredo como matrimonio. Se pueden besar.
The audience calls out for kisses. It's a joyous moment and also fleeting. The next morning, around half of this group leaves the shelter. They've been receiving threats in Tijuana, so they're changing locations every few days for their safety. Belle says this journey to the U.S. has been horrible. She wouldn't wish it on anybody, but she's determined. She wants to get to New York City, and if she makes it, she says, she's going to write a book all about the migrant caravan. For the World, Emily Green, Tijuana, Mexico.
At one point, President Trump tweeted about, quote, unknown Middle Easterners in the migrant caravan. The Department of Homeland Security even claimed, without offering evidence, that 500 criminals were mixed in with the group of several thousand people. So no shortage of caravan rumors. But we learn now about a different group of people making the trek. According to Julia Ainsley, national security reporter for NBC News, at least a handful of them are spies. Ainsley says officials at the Department of Homeland Security told her that they are paying some migrants to work as undercover informants.
My interest got piqued on a press call that the Department of Homeland Security had with reporters a few days ago, where they talked about their reasoning to close down a border crossing into Tijuana. They closed down the northern lanes on Sunday nights, and they said they did so because of intelligence that they got. Intelligence that said that these immigrants were preparing to basically ambush the border and come in through the car lanes. Now, that never happened, so you can question whether or not they actually were trying to use that as an excuse to shut down traffic or to prepare for something else, or whether or not that intelligence was completely accurate. But I just started getting really interested in how are they finding out about these movements? How do they know where they're going? How do they know where they plan to sleep? How do they know when they're going to branch off? And so I started asking around. I've been reporting on this for about 5 years now within the Department of Homeland Security, and found out very conclusively that yes, there are paid informants. And not only that, they're also monitoring their communications. They're able to join the WhatsApp groups that these immigrants have used to pinpoint where they'll meet and where they'll travel from there.
So you mentioned the rhetoric around criminals being part of the caravan. Donald Trump has said it numerous times. Do we know if these insiders have actually detected criminals within the caravan?
I've been able to obtain intelligence reports almost daily for the past few weeks that is based a lot on what these insiders are telling the Department of Homeland Security. But no, it doesn't seem that there is an increased level of criminal activity. The CIA is not involved in this. That's who they would have to use as informants if there was a real terror threat. And I've spoken to some former officers who have been able to steer me on that.
So all this energy and money and resources being spent to spy on a group of people who want asylum in the U.S., but by any other measure don't represent a risk significant to this country that would warrant spies, one would think. Is more important spycraft getting less attention right now?
Well, that's exactly the criticism that John Cohen talked to me about. He is the former acting undersecretary of the Department of Homeland Security Intelligence. He talked about how this is not a decision he would have made when he was in the job. He sees the major threats that DHS should be addressing right now to be cyber attacks, to be thwarting mass shootings, to be concerned about fentanyl coming through the mail. And it is not a major national security threat that is being posed by this caravan.
So the caravan is not headed anywhere near Arizona, but U.S. troops have been deployed there. You traveled to Nogales, Arizona. I'd like you to just set the scene for us. Like, what were the soldiers doing? What did you see?
The first I saw were hanging concertina wire. That's an image we've seen a lot for anyone paying attention to what the troops are down there. We see them stretching out really near the border crossing, which is interesting considering if they're coming toward a border crossing, they're most likely going to walk up to an agent and turn themselves in, not try to scale a 30-foot wall. But what I found most surprising, really made my jaw drop, were the men who were waiting for a forklift. And they were waiting from the men hanging the wire to be finished, that they could borrow this forklift to build barricades. And each day they would build another barricade. These are two shipping containers stacked on top of each other with barbed wire at the top. And they are to be used in case they need to completely seal a border crossing. There are 30 of these just sitting idle on the pavement, not blocking any lanes, not doing anything. Meanwhile, these men have to get up and do the same thing every day.
Yeah, men and women, I see from the photos.
They definitely men and women, just happen to be men who I saw building those barricades.
So Thanksgiving is upon us. Any sense of what the holiday will be like for these troops?
They will be pulling those men and women back from Nogales to the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base for a Thanksgiving meal. They say that they won't be eating those prepackaged MREs that you've seen in the past, that they've been eating since they've gotten there, that local vendors will be supplying a full Thanksgiving meal with the turkey and the gravy and the pies and the stuffing and everything that we think about. They will have that. They even said they may have a football game with some of their soldiers versus the Air Force, who are already permanently on that base. But, you know, mentally, the holiday does make it tough because everyone would want to be with their family. And it just really puts the mission, or lack thereof, into a clearer focus. And I think people start asking themselves more questions about why they're deployed specifically over a holiday.
Yeah. Well, a home-cooked meal, I think, is the very least those troops deserve. But on Friday, what is it, back to the border again? Back to Nogales?
That's right. Back to work. And right now, these men and women are really in the dark as far as where they'll go next. Even a lot of these top commanders don't know what their next move will be.
Julia Ainslie, a national security reporter for NBC News. Good to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
In case you missed the warning, get rid of that romaine lettuce and then disinfect the fridge. Seriously, that is the advice from the CDC. There's been an outbreak of E. coli in the U.S. and Canada. Dozens of people are sick, and romaine lettuce is probably to blame. It's not clear yet how the lettuce was contaminated, but countless heads of romaine have been recalled. My next guest, Ramesh Gopinath, says massive recalls like this one might soon be a thing of the past. He's a vice president at IBM in charge of a project called the Food Trust. Gopinath says the key to preventing these sorts of outbreaks is to keep track of every head of lettuce at every point along the global supply chain. The way to do that is by using blockchain, the technology behind Bitcoin.
Think about it, right? If you have a problem like you just described with romaine lettuce, for example, you want to be able to say, where exactly did this head of lettuce come from, right? You want to trace backwards along the supply chain all the way back to the farm. And maybe the problem happened at the farm or somewhere along the way. Once you discover the point where something happened, you want to also be able to trace forwards to figure out where all is this tainted product available. That's precisely what we are trying to solve with IBM Food Trust. That is why you need a blockchain.
So blockchain, if I get blockchain correctly, it's basically like a giant three-dimensional Excel spreadsheet, kind of a wiki spreadsheet that everybody can contribute to and correct if they see mistakes. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I think that mental model is right. Think of it as a giant spreadsheet or a simple database. Once you have such a platform, folks in the food ecosystem can start sharing the information about where I got the lettuce from, what did I do with it? Did I, you know, just pack as heads of lettuce, or did I chop it into pieces and it goes into some salad packet, et cetera, right? And then where do I send it out to? So for us, blockchain is just an underlying technology that enables the trusted permission information sharing. But much of the magic is about ensuring that you can then trace backwards and forwards in the supply chain to pinpoint and get to surgical recalls. But then one more interesting point I want to mention is it's not just food safety that we're talking about here, but also food freshness. I would love to have my strawberries last longer in the fridge when I buy from the store, right? Or food fraud. People have been, passing off horse meat as beef and organic food. In fact, the funny story is more organic food is consumed than is produced. All these problems, at the end of the day, we view this as information sharing problems.
So how far along is the IBM Food Trust in a comprehensive tracking of food?
We started on this journey about 2 years ago, and we did a pilot with mangoes for moving from Mexico to the United States. And we were able to show that you can do traceability in a couple of seconds as opposed to weeks. And that's what led to us working with Walmart, Kroger, Nestle, et cetera. And as of October 8th, we announced that this is now widely available for commercial purchase by anybody across the globe.
So I want you to just walk me through it. Imagine I'm the manager of a supermarket and I find a mango that I want to know more about. I mean, if you didn't have this technology, what would you do? I mean, how would you find out the provenance of any food product?
Think of it as there is multiple hops from the source to destination, right? Mm. Say 10 hops, let's say. Every hop, basically, you have a party calling the previous party and saying, look, tell me more about where this package came from, right? Give me its provenance. And then they would go, literally with phone calls and emails and faxes or whatever else. They do it manually, much of it. That is why it takes, a week to do the mango example that I mentioned earlier, right? Much of it happens manually today.
And now with blockchain, it goes much quicker?
You get it instantaneously. So it's like off the order of a second.
Ramesh Gopinath, the vice president at IBM. Thanks for telling us about this. Really amazing stuff.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is, of course, Thanksgiving. I've got the world's Rupa Shenoy here. And 2 years ago, Rupa, you gave a shout out to hear from people who were considering how to deal in 2016 with this new political reality, how to deal with it around the dinner table.
Right. You'll remember we had just elected Donald Trump. And some people were really stunned and heading into a holiday with family they didn't agree with. And not much has changed since then. We're all pretty divided.
Yeah, and not just here. I mean, look at the UK and Brexit. It's dividing families. Or look at Germany and pressure to accept refugees or not. That's Angela Merkel's Achilles heel. And then there's the recent election of far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil as president. So Brazilians are also dealing with a new political reality. You're going to remember this voice, Rupa. Recently, reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro introduced us to the problems facing one family in Brazil.
She and her mom have voted differently in the past, but this time it became impossible to talk with her mother about all this.
So Brazilian families, too, are bracing for awkward conversations over the Christmas table next month, even canceling plans altogether. Again, echoes of what we're seeing here in the States.
So I wanted to check back in with some of the people that called us in 2016 to see what this looks like 2 years on. And before I tell you some of what I heard, I want to issue a few caveats. Of course, this is not scientific or representative for a lot of reasons. And one is that, of course, the public radio audience skews liberal,
right,
and these people are self-selected, stuff like that.
All right. So proceeding with those caveats in mind, Rupa, what did you hear generally?
There were many families that kind of broke up after the 2016 election, didn't go to Thanksgiving together, and still haven't gotten back together. But by and large, a lot of people said their families worked through the tension by deciding not to talk about politics. Mm. One example is a guy named Nathan I talked to. He's from Atlanta. 2 years ago, he sent me a message. He said he was the kind of guy who usually speaks his mind, but that year was going to be his first with his fiancée's family. And apparently they were very vocally on the opposite side of the political spectrum.
So this will be the first Thanksgiving that I will have to bite my tongue, and I really don't know how it's going to go.
So that was 2 years ago, and now he says he's still biting his tongue with his fiancée's family. And yes, they're still in the engagement phase. It's a long one.
Whenever something, it seems, inadvertently gets said that's politically divisive, there's just an awkward silence that falls over, and then someone tries to break the silence by a complete non sequitur.
I know what he's talking about, which is kind of funny, but it's also kind of sad.
It is sad. Nathan thinks that people have decided that there's no point in talking to people who disagree with them because no one's going to change their mind. And Nathan says, yeah, that might be right, but that also means that people are missing out on opportunities to connect.
I would think, you know, like, you're at a nice meal that everyone's contributed to, that would be the time that hopefully you could be cordial and actually discuss with people.
Yeah, and from personal experience, not being able to talk about certain things, it just kind of changes your relationship with your family.
And some people really felt loss because of that. This is how Elizabeth from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, 2 years ago, described how she planned to handle dinner with her politically divided family.
It's actually pretty uncomfortable. I personally deal with it by attempting to keep up my 10-minute a night meditation practice so that I can avoid reacting.
And 2 years on, she's using the same method, but
it does feel lonely. I think that that's the takeaway that I would say. You know, there's times where you just really want to share what's on your mind with your family because you're close. And then if they are completely in another, seeing the world so much differently, yeah, you just kind of miss that.
Rupa, did any of the families that broke up and decided not to spend Thanksgiving together 2 years ago, did any of them get back together?
To a certain extent. This is Sally from Salem, Oregon, 2 years ago. She called in to say her family wasn't going to her mother's house because they disagreed about politics.
I blocked my own mother on Facebook and Instagram the day after the election results. When she texted me to ask for an explanation, I told her I needed a break from politics, and she started texting me about her politics. So I repeated my text and asked her to stop, but she got angry, and I'll probably never go home again.
Wow, that is an intense story.
And it was a catalyst for Sally. She completely changed her life after that, reassessed her priorities. Like, she got divorced. But she and her family, her extended family, like her mom, they didn't talk. They didn't even text until about 5 months ago. Sally started reaching out with just silly memes, just stuff like that. They started talking, and Sally went home for her mother's 80th birthday.
Going home for the 80th was a big deal. You know, going home and celebrating that and surprising mom and just letting her know that I'm here and I'm not going anywhere and she wants to have a relationship, I'm in. It just, I was finally ready to do that, and that was a good thing.
Okay, that's hopeful. And her mom was in, too?
Yeah, and they do still have disagreements, but they've learned to have those disagreements and then move on and be a family.
Are they spending this Thanksgiving together?
Sally says she would go visit her mom if she had the money, but she doesn't.
Yeah, the economics, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. Aside from that, though, that is a hopeful story. You and I, Rupa, we started talking a moment ago by looking at these family political divisions happening all over the world. What do people you talk to think that actually means, this kind of universal division?
They all think that this may last a while. At first, they thought, you know, 2 years ago, it was going to be one uncomfortable Thanksgiving. Now people are trying to accept that this is probably how it'll be from now on.
Yeah, probably what people in Brazil are thinking too right now. Rupa Shenoy, thanks very much for sharing what you found out with us.
Thank you, Marco.
We often let you know here on The World about important musicians who've died, giving you a little insight into the impact artists have had, artists you may not have heard of. Today, though, it's not an obit. It's a happy birthday song for the great Lebanese singer Fairuz. Fairuz turns 83 today. Fairuz, a single name. If you're Lebanese, no matter how many Fairuzes you know personally, there really is only one. Kifak Inta is the title of the song. It means, how are you? A question the singer puts to a man she's not seen in a while. No doubt some of the people you'll see tomorrow on Thanksgiving are ones you've not seen for some time. And as I think about my conversation a moment ago with Rupa, it strikes me that, how are you? It's a great opening question. Anyway, make it a restful holiday. I'll be away until Monday. Carol Hills is on deck here tomorrow at the World's Nana Bill Harris Studios. We leave you today with more from Fairuz.
PRI, Public Radio International.